So it turns out when we do put ourselves at the edge of the water, visually our field of view is simplified. Auditorily, our world is simplified. Your sensory input gets simple. It doesn't completely turn off. It doesn't go away. But the patterns become more clear. When you get into the water, assuming that you want to be in the water, it's totally different if you get thrown into the water. That's more of a red mind experience. But assuming that this is all taking place and you're in control, the waves are small, the water's warm, and you want to be there, then you give up the gravity. So the hundreds of muscles that have been holding you in that position that you were standing in no longer need to do the work. And the brain regions that were taking care of that aspect of living on land get a break. So auditorily, visually, somatically, you're getting a break. You're getting a rest. So what happens is you kind of go into what's often referred to as the default mode, or the default mode network is activated, which is a more contemplative, self-referential perspective.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Jay, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
My pleasure. Really looking forward to this chat.
Yeah. So, you know, I have come across your work because I know of your book, Blue Mind, which is all about the science of what the ocean does to us and what water does to us. And, you know, given who I am and what I'm all about, naturally, I was incredibly intrigued by all of this work. And coincidentally, right as this thought was going through my mind, you know, we were making a list of guests we should have, and your name was on our list, and you tweeted something that I'd wrote. So it made really kind of a nice time to reach out to you. So I want to start with something that I think has been really interesting to hear from different people. And that is, what is it that you wanted to be when you grew up, when you were a kid, that ultimately led you down this trajectory?
You know, I have a very unoriginal answer to that question. I wanted to be a marine biologist. I like maybe half the world's population at some point in their lives. And specifically, I wanted to be Jacques Cousteau's like wingman. That was kind of what I wanted. And again, I guess I joined a lot of people who dreamed of that. And that seemed ridiculous, especially, you know, I'm 48. So basically back then, we didn't have all of this information available about, you know, how to become a marine biologist. So everybody around me basically said, yeah, good luck with that. He's already got the job, referring to Jacques, and not a lot of encouragement. So you kind of had to put your head down, as with many, you know, many dreams, and just keep plugging away at it. But yeah, I wanted to be a marine biologist, and it's simply because I loved the way I felt when I was near, in, on, especially underwater. That felt like the best version of the young me. And I thought, I want to feel that way all the time, even when I'm at work. And I figured marine biologist or maybe pro surfer would be the two paths. So I was very into science and math. And so marine biology seemed like the way to go.
You know, it's interesting that you use the exact words, I want to feel this way all the time, because that was literally my thought the moment I caught a wave and stood up for the first time, the day I got out of the water on that beach in Brazil. Like, that was the one thing that went through my mind, so much so that I literally wrote those exact words in my book. I'm really curious why you think people miss moments of, you know, realizing that, hey, this is a way I want to feel all the time in their lives, and why they can't find a way to connect that feeling to something they want to do with their lives often.
You know, I think there are a lot of people who you know, take their dream, you know, in my case, to be a marine biologist, and then at some point, at some juncture, they start burying it, and they start burying it pretty deep. And then they pop out at some point later and maybe have the opportunity to unearth it, to start digging and find that buried dream, maybe wistfully Maybe they've made some money and they can actually really do it up. But I meet people all the time who have taken that dream and buried it real deep, suffered some of the consequences of, you know, having buried their dream, and then start digging it up later in life. I just decided I didn't want to do it that way, that I wanted to live my dream, as it sounds so cliche, but I just tried to figure out how to do that. And you make compromises, I suppose, financial compromises, among others, to do, you know, what you're passionate about, or what you dreamed of doing, and to you know, live in a way that doesn't really feel like it's ever a job, or it's, you know, work that you're strapped to. And at a young age, I just had that prioritized, for whatever reason. Maybe because I watched my dad and his work. He had a desk job, and he did it really well. He was, you know, first at his desk in the morning and last to leave at the end of the day, because that's the way he was. He was a hardworking guy. And I just watched that and thought, hell no, no way. I'm not going to do that. And so early on, I guess that's a gift from my dad. I decided I'm going to align my dreams and my work, and make that work out. But you know, I don't know. Everybody's got a different story. I'm not going to even try to explain why people bury their dreams or they don't. I can just tell you my version of it.
You know, it's interesting to hear you listen, to listen to you describe, you know, the experience of watching your dad. And it's funny because, I mean, you could have that same experience and two people could have completely different reactions to it. Like, one person could say, hell no, which you did. And I think you and I share that in common. My dad's a professor, and I kind of looked at what I didn't want to be. Not that, you know, there's anything wrong with it, but I just thought, this is not the life that I want to lead. And you know, I also saw a lot of people older than me that I just couldn't fathom spending my life doing what they're doing. You know, you look at movies like Office Space. I think each one of my friends in college kind of laughed it off when we saw it the first time, and we were like, okay. And they're like, yeah, but that's just life. We have to accept that. I think to me, the reaction was much more visceral, thinking, oh my God, this is what we're headed for.
Right. Yeah, no, that, I mean, yeah, it's fear and love are two big motivators. And, you know, if you see something that really scares the heck out of you, you know, you'll move away from it. If you see something that you really love, you move towards it. And, and I think, I fell in love with the ocean at a young age and said, I'm going to move strongly in that direction. And had a similar reaction, obviously, to, you know, seeing different ways people work. And some of those ways just scared me. So that sort of pushed me maybe further down the path of marine biology.
So walk me through the journey from, you know, realizing as a kid that you wanted to be a marine biologist through sort of high school, early college, all of that stuff that ultimately leads to the work that you've done around BlueMind and all of this. Like, how do you go from that early inkling to where you're at today?
Yeah, so, you know, I guess I've always known that the ocean, being in water, makes us feel good, and from a personal experience. But meeting people like you throughout my life and throughout my career, who have a similar story, like, wow, this is awesome. This is where I want to be. I'm going to figure out how to do this more often. And as a marine biologist, we're not really allowed to talk about that stuff. So I went through, I guess you could say, you know, traditional education. I got my master's degree in environmental economics at Duke, and then did a PhD in wildlife ecology and evolutionary biology, studying sea turtles in Mexico. And, you know, did publish tons of papers on biology, marine biology, animal migration, genetics, conservation. And all along realized that there's this big missing piece, which is our brain, the human brain, and this driver that drove me to want to be a marine biologist and many others to care deeply about the ocean, including, you know, people who fishermen, fisherwomen, people who hunt sea turtles, people who do whale watching for a living. This deeper drive to just connect with big water seemed so interesting and so important. And I'd always been fascinated by neuroscience as it sort of was growing in the background and becoming more mainstream in terms of the writings and speaking about it. And one day I thought, well, there's got to be a book about this. There's a book about your brain on music. There's a book about your brain on food. There's a book, many, about your brain on happiness, and on. And many of the people you've spoken to on your show have brought to bear neuroscience on the thing that they do. And I thought, there's got to be a book out there about water in your brain, because it's the single biggest feature of our planet. And our brain is the most complex thing in the universe. So somebody must have picked up on that and written a book about those two things together. And I didn't find the book I was looking for. And I was very disappointed. I thought, well, maybe it's in German, or maybe it's out of print, or maybe it's in Japanese. So I just kept searching and coming up short, and then tried to get somebody else to write it. And I fell short. And I remember a day that I actually pitched the idea to Oliver Sacks, and it was a hero of mine, the late great neurologist, who's also a brilliant writer, amazing thinker, and loves the water. And he said, "That's a good idea. You do it." And I was like, "Oh, crap! Oliver Sacks said you do it." And so, game on. That was the deal. That was kind of the moment. I was like, "I'm going to do this, and I'm going to have to learn a lot. I'm going to have to hang out with people other than marine biologists and surfers." And it took about 5 years, and we had an annual conference. We still have that conference called the Blue Mind Summit. And those conferences basically became the building blocks and the raw material for building this conversation. And it's more than a book. Actually, very few people, even though the book's done well, very few people have actually read it. More people have engaged with the conversation in their own personal way. And so that's kind of the quick path from turtles, sea turtles, to neuroscience. And I'm not a neuroscientist. I'm an ecologist, and I have a background in economics as well. But I realized that neuropsychology could possibly help us address some of these big problems that the water parts of the planet are facing.
So we'll get really deep into the neuroscience of all this, because I am so morbidly curious about all of it. But, I want to ask you another question that is more sort of, abstract. You mentioned that you had this desire to see this thing, like you kept searching for this book only to discover that you were going to be the one that had to write it. And I think that all of us have something like that in our lives, something that we want to see exist in the world. I'm just curious, if you were to guide somebody on how to find it, what would you tell them?
I think just as you say, we all have that. And if you were asked, what is it? The first thing you think of is probably it. I think that we've all been, turning an idea over and over and over in our heads for a long time. And not finding, all the information, all the answers. And if you ask someone, what is that thing for you? Probably the next thing you should suggest is, don't think too hard. Just say whatever popped into your head just now, and write that down. I ask my colleague scientists, what's the thing you know that you can't prove? And just quick, tell me, whether it's something with sea turtles or something with waves or something with your kids, what's the thing you know that you can't prove? And maybe that's the thing that you might want to dig into for your next big idea. But it's I think it's really makes life really interesting, to take those things and devote some time to them and start connecting the dots. And if there isn't enough research, find the research that sort of scatters around the dot that you're looking at and start connecting those dots. And you get this web of really interesting insights. And that's how science works, actually. It's how big ideas are formed. They're not already preformed, sitting there waiting. They're waiting for you to connect the dots and start building that, you know, that structure and scaffolding. So, I'd say you've got it right there. It's in the front of your mind. Just get it out. Don't be afraid. I think that's probably maybe the best advice. Is I've been told at least 7 times that what I was doing was career suicide by people who I respected, advisors and professors and teachers and mentors. And so far, it hasn't been. and there's something interesting there, that you're told by people who know a lot that what you're doing is a really bad idea. Not just a bad idea, but a career wrecking idea. And to have that not be the case many times over, I've been thinking about it a lot. Is it what that feeling that I get when I know that the seemingly bad idea is in fact a good idea? Mm-hmm. You have to start to pay attention to that feeling. And then the reverse is true. You know, you may be, in fact, be absolutely delusional. that's a possibility. And you should learn to figure out the difference inside your own head. Yeah.
I appreciate that perspective, as you can imagine, because I'm sure I've been told on more than one occasion that I was headed down the path of career suicide and even thought it myself. Yeah. I guess, the bigger question, you said, we have to learn to recognize the difference. And I think, anybody who's got a reasonably intelligent mind can pretty quickly figure out the difference. But I think the real challenge in my mind when you feel that what you're doing might be career suicide is dealing with the fear and the very debilitating internal narrative that comes with it. And I'm curious, the narrative internally can become very debilitating when the external narrative is all, reinforcing it. So I'm curious how you've overcome that.
The fear. Yeah. That, I think it's one thing to talk about this in hindsight, and it's a complete other thing to talk about it, as you're entering into, the unknown or the new thing or the big wave, as the case may be. I think we assign courage as an observation after the fact. And usually you don't assign it to yourself. Usually that's up to society or the people around you to say, wow, that was courageous. That was brave. It doesn't feel like that, when you're going in, for me at least, it feels more, like a very confident white knuckle ride, those two things can go together. Where when you have a sense of something and you can see that mental map and you can see the path towards that vision of whatever it is that you're imagining, and it starts to become more clear, and then you say, okay, let's go, let's do it. Let's start to take the steps down this path and make adjustments. But you have this idea of how it's going to look as it unfolds. And it's really exciting when it in fact does. But there's, there's some holding your breath and some really, really scary moments. I probably no surprise when the stress builds or the potential for stress builds, I just take it to the water. That's my drug. That's my medicine.
Yeah.
Whether it's just sitting on a bench with my family watching the sunset, or getting in the water, getting into a wave, or just slipping underwater and holding my breath for as long as I can, that's my medicine. That's my little escape valve. And you need to have that. I know a lot of people who have big ideas and then have big, ugly burnout experiences because they didn't have that that water, whatever the water would be in their lives. So that's a big important piece if you're going to take on something truly new and edgy and go through that probably at least 5-year process. Make sure you've got some water, metaphorically and literally.
You know, I think it's interesting that you mentioned that it's in at least a 5-year process. And I've heard that idea reinforced so many times that, you know, I think it was James Altucher said reinvention is a 5-year process at a minimum. Like the first year you're kind of flailing, the second year, you know, there's some hope. The third year you start making money. The fourth year you have a career. The fifth year you have something sustainable.
Yeah. Yeah. And I, 5 years, to 10 years. The big projects that I've worked on that, you know, that I could finally take a step away from and say, this worked and it's not, it's not going away. Even if I do, that was about 10 years. And not that that's a magic number or anything, but, it's good to keep in mind because I think in my world, the grant cycle, you're lucky if it's 2 years. You know, if you got 2 years of funding, you're lucky because lots of folks just get a year. If you get more than 2 years of funding, you're doing high fives and jumping around. But we're increasingly geared and expecting these short-term returns and these quick wins and the startup mindset is not necessarily thinking in terms of a decade. Mm-hmm. A decade is, an eternity in a lot of fields.
Yeah.
But it really is what, you should expect that. And if it's a 5-year run, then, good for you. But, commit to 10 years on a big idea.
Yeah.
And expect it. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's do this. Let's shift gears a little bit and let's start getting into the neuroscience of why water has the impact on the brain that it does. What are the impacts on the brain? What did you discover in your research? What surprised you about what you discovered? I mean, let's do a deep dive into all of this.
Well, I'd say the most surprising thing, and I mentioned this earlier, was that this research hadn't been just completely on the top of everybody's agenda. I was just, as a marine biologist and a water guy, I just thought, wow, this would be the coolest thing for any neuroscientist to study. And there must be literally thousands of people just jamming on this research. And not true. There's far more research on your brain on music and your brain on food and a variety of other aspects of our lives than there is on the simplest thing being water. So that kind of required really searching out the little pockets of work that had been done, which has increased over the past few years, and also connecting the dots and just taking a step back and saying, all right, what happens when we step up to the water? What is different about stepping up to the water versus stepping out into onto a sidewalk or into a forest? Is there anything different? And unpacking that. And so it turns out when we do put ourselves at the edge of the water, visually our field of view is simplified. Auditorily, our world is simplified. Your sensory input gets simple. It doesn't completely turn off, doesn't go away, but the patterns become more clear. When you get into the water, assuming that you want to be in the water, it's totally different if you get thrown into the water. That's that's more of a red mind experience. But assuming that this is all taking place and you're in control, the waves are small, the water's warm, and you want to be there, then you give up the gravity. So the hundreds of muscles that have been holding you in that position that you were standing in no longer need to do the work. And the brain regions that were taking care of that aspect of living on land, get a break. So auditorily, visually, somatically, you're getting a break, you're getting a rest. So what happens is you kind of go into what's often referred to as the default mode, or the default mode network is activated, which is a more contemplative, self-referential perspective. And your brain doesn't just shut down because you don't have this auditory and complex visual input. It starts to go to work on some other thing. So you have this different feeling that I call blue mind. And it's, you know, a mildly meditative sense of being more connected to yourself, more connected to your environment, more connected to the people around you if you happen to be with a loved one or a friend. And it's different than stepping out onto the sidewalk, or sitting here in this room that I'm in, or even taking a walk in the forest. And so there's a lot in that that just sounds so simple and so obvious, but there's a lot in that. That mindset, that, you know, default mode, opens us up to a whole big toolbox of cognitive, emotional, psychological, and social skills that are not always available to us in our red mind mode, where we're just rushing around, where we're processing lots of visual information, where we're taking in and filtering lots of sound. And it's worth considering that as a piece of how we live. And I guess I would say reminding ourselves, you know, to take that time and break away and find your water, whatever it may be. And it's, you know, for me, it's the Pacific Ocean, two blocks away. For some people, it's their bathtub. For some people, it's the pond or the lake or the river in their town. And so that's that's kind of the broadest brush, I guess you could say. But when you get down into it, there are all kinds of really incredible applications. So for people who are, say, extremely stressed out, suffering from post-traumatic stress, water can be among the best therapies available. For people who are extremely distracted and just kind of can't really settle down and get thinking about something that needs their attention, just taking themselves to the edge of the water can open up, you know, the creative process. And artists and musicians have known this for a long time, as have entrepreneurs and scientists. And it, you know, it really is a simple idea, but you know, hopefully conversations like this one can nudge us back to making space, you know, in our lives for a little bit more blue mind time. Yeah.
So many questions, as you might imagine.
Yeah.
So, you know, I love that you brought up the idea that, you know, this idea of water is accessible to anybody, because I was thinking about this, you know, like at the moment I'm not, you know, a stone's throw away from the water. So I have to pick my surfing days very carefully. And, you know, in the midst of writing a book, ironically, organized in surf metaphors, I didn't get as much surfing in as I thought I would. But I think the idea that, you know, it's accessible to us through something as simple as a shower is really interesting to me, because, you know, often a lot of the ideas that I write about occur in the shower, and that's not an uncommon occurrence. You know, one of the things I'm really just curious about is why we have the feeling that we do when we come out of the water. And I'm curious, you know, that feeling that I get coming out of the water, can anybody experience that regardless of whatever the body of water is? Like, what is happening to my brain, like neurologically, when I've gotten out of the water after a surf session where I've caught a lot of waves?
So, you know, that's a great example, surfing. So if you take surfing and you rip it apart, part of it is exercise, just plain and simple. So you could exercise your body in a similar way, without the waves, without the ocean. So, and there's a ton of research on You know, exercise being really good, obviously for your body, but also for your brain, right? For helping you to regulate stress, helping your brain to just be a better brain and to reduce the, you know, the harmful chemicals and to boost the good ones, the feel good chemicals. So you get this endorphin high from exercise of any kind that, you know, your brain is full of these feel good chemicals at the end of a workout. So when you're getting out of the water after a surf session, you've got that along with all these other aspects of being near in on and under the water. So you add to that the sound, the rhythmic sound of the ocean, which puts you in kind of a synchrony or in that sort of, you know, scientists even call it a groove. There's some really cool research that's come out about rhythm in the brain, and it turns out that your synchrony with the rhythm occurs subconsciously. So even without trying, even without really being a musician, you get into the groove with whatever the rhythm is just by being in the presence of those sound waves. So a similar thing happens when you're on the ocean. So you're out there getting into a groove with the ocean. You're exercising. You're having this set of experiences that are accumulated, and I call it blue mind. So, you know, we can kind of go deeper and deeper into the various levels, the various physiologies of that experience, from the salt water, to the taste of the ocean, in your mouth, that feeling of, having it actually just pour out of your sinuses, as the case may be, as you're emerging from the water. But it's all of that combined, which is really unique. I think it kind of brings up a couple of topics that are getting a lot of attention, at least in the surf world these days. The wave pools, the artificial waves, and the virtual reality waves, and are those going to be somehow a replacement or a supplement to going out into a real ocean and real waves? And I think when you understand a little bit about the neuropsychology aspects of surfing, you kind of will kind of understand that a wave pool is not going. Wave pool is not going to replace that oceanic experience. A virtual reality wave is not going to replace even a little real wave. I'll take 15 seconds of real ocean over a virtual ocean any day, and that's because there are this immersive sensory experience that you're not really going to have, even in a wave pool, which is real water. It's a real wave, but it's sanitized in a sense. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, psychologists refer to this sense of soft fascination, which we get when we're on a surfboard or sitting on the beach, which is it holds your attention, but it doesn't dominate your attention. And so the ocean is changing. It's sending different little packets of information at you. There may be a fin, there may be a bird. The breeze may pick up. It holds your interest, but at the same time, it isn't a massive amount of information that's distracting. So you get to enter into this blue mind mode, or this, this mildly meditative state.
So, the other thing that I think often, at least I've experienced, is that we come out and we find flow, and that flow seems to me to carry into all of my other work. If I write after a surf session, the writing, the entire experience of writing is completely different than writing on any normal day. Like, I can just sit down, open up a notebook, and I can probably write for an hour or two, and I don't even have to think. Like, it just, literally flows. I'm curious how we might bring the sense of flow into our lives if we're not surfers or people who are, able to easily immerse ourselves in the ocean.
Yeah, it's interesting that, you know, the just the concept of flow is a water metaphor. Mm-hmm. That we're, you know, and any conversations about creativity and flow are just really full of water metaphors. And you know, as a writer and as a thinker, you know that they're unavoidable. You end up tripping over them all the time. And there's a reason, you know, for that. It's, you know, and I think it's because we have this deep fundamental evolutionary connection to water. It's, you know, it's the matrix of life. It's most of our bodies. If you don't have water, you're going to be dead within a week. And so it makes sense that we would find the right spot relative to water to be both beautiful and satisfying, and allow us to you know, maybe our guard to drop a bit. And that's kind of what, you know, what flow is about, is that you know, kind of relaxing into what you know well and letting the creativity happen, you know, breaking down all of the barriers and all of the reasons to not doing something or not improvising on something that you know so well. And, you know, water, you know, literally and metaphorically allows us to do that and allows you to move in all different directions. It takes away, you know, this relentless field of gravity that's you know, dragging us down, making us feel heavy. Where we're in the water, we get relief from that. If we have, you know, physical injuries and barriers in the water, those go away. If we're clumsy on land, in water, we're less so. And, you know, and that works literally and metaphorically. So, you know, everybody's got their different answer to that question. And, it, you know, it's clearly it's not surfing for everyone. But getting into a pool, you know, down the street and having a conversation there with someone that you know, were planning maybe to have an indoor conversation with, getting out to the edge of a river that runs through your city and holding a meeting there instead of in a cubicle, or, you know, instead of in a busy cafe, sitting out by an urban fountain. I find, urban fountains to be really, underutilized sources of creative conversations. Something really cool about an, you know, urban fountain is when you sit on the bench near it, you're kind of in a privacy bubble with the person that you're with. And somebody literally 8 feet away often cannot hear your conversation because of the sound of the water. So in this world of decreasing privacy and lack of solitude, just sitting by a fountain in the middle of a city can afford you just that sense of intimacy in conversation, whether it's with a loved one or a coworker. And that intimacy, that connection, allows us to open up into a whole new kind of interaction, maybe, you know, a better quality conversation. So, you know, there's this kind of an endless list of possible tools and applications to this broad idea of bringing more water into your life. And it doesn't require a tropical vacation and doesn't always require a surfboard, certainly.
It's funny. I think I'm going to take every date I have going forward to a fountain after hearing this.
Yeah, do it. And then let me know how it goes.
Yeah, I definitely will. Well, let's do this. I want to ask a few questions that I normally haven't asked, but I've started to in interviews. What is one book, piece of art, music, documentary, or film that has profoundly influenced your life that you would want to share with our audience?
Well, the first thing that popped into my head, and probably because you said book first, but and I love books, is this little novella called The River Swimmer. Was written by Jim Harrison, a great writer who passed away this past year. I love that little book. And if anybody is listening to this conversation and this theme of water is you You know, if it feels like we're talking about you, you will love that book. It's called The River Swimmer by Jim Harrison, and it's just a beautiful, stunning little novella, one of his last of his career. I highly recommend it. It's one of those reads that you will read it in one night because you won't want to stop. That's the first thing that popped into my head. And it's just The River Swimmer.
So in the spirit of beginning research for my next book, this is another thing that I haven't asked a lot of people, but what are your daily habits and routines like? What is a typical day in your life like?
You know, I don't have a typical day. I think it's, and that's maybe by design, maybe every day is kind of different. It's the things that are similar day to day, you know, waking up, getting the kids out the door to school, but every day is really different. I love that. Some people would find that really distracting or really difficult, but I love that every day is an adventure, and every there's not a real clear pattern. You know, of course, when you're writing, you need to block out writing time, but even writing, I do it everywhere and anywhere that it comes to me. You know, whether it's on an airplane or you know, sitting late at night, in the middle of the night, I'll get up and write. There's a real lack of balance, I guess you could say, to that approach. So I prefer creative disequilibrium as a concept, which again, it sort of ties back to the water theme. The waves right out here that I'm looking at right now are not really balanced. It's crazy. It's a crazy motion of water molecules and wind. And it's always different. You know, all the waves they're always different. All the little wavelets are different. And so, I've never been able to achieve balance or really find a pattern or a schedule in my life, and it maybe drives my spouse and coworkers a little crazy. But I'm all about creative disequilibrium. So I don't know if that even answered your question.
It definitely does. So. I have one last question for you, which is how we finish all our interviews at The Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Unmistakable. You know, I think it's a question of paying attention. I think if you pay attention, everything and everyone is unmistakable. I think if one pays attention to what's going on around them, they become unmistakable. The insights that you may have, that date that you're going to have next to the fountain, by paying attention to the person you're with and the water around you, you become unmistakable, and as do they. And so I think that's it's about attention, about focusing our attention and harnessing it and going there and that's something that's less and less common, I guess, that the attention span is shorter, or the ability to slow down and really pay attention, really hear, really see. But I think that's what makes any moment or any person, or any place unmistakable, is just a focused attention.
Well, this has been really cool. I am really, really thrilled that we got a chance to connect, and, I really, really appreciate you taking the time to join us and, share your story and your insights with our listeners.
My pleasure. And, I really hope you get in the water as much as possible while you're getting through this writing process, and look forward to reading about all of that soon from your book.
Yeah. Awesome. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.